Hello, and welcome to Spy Hard's podcast, where your hosts go deep undercover into the world of spy movies to decipher which films make the knock list. But remember, this information is strictly for your ears only. I'm Agent Scott.
Tell them I'm in my chair!
And I'm Cam the Provocateur.
What an entrance. Welcome to the show, Cam.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm in my chair.
You are. You clearly are in your chair. We've got a great film to talk about this week and a very great guest joining us. But before we get there, we need to induct our latest Spy Hards Die Hard. Now, if you don't know how to become one, Cam, tell the people.
You can become a Spy Hards Die Hard by leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and telling us what you enjoy about the show. Or what you don't. If you want to sneak something in under a 5-star review, that's okay to us. Those 5 stars still, you know, rack up. So that's all fine. But yeah, we read your review on the air, and then I give you your special Spy Hards Die Hards code name.
Well, here is your latest inductee, folks. This one comes from the United States Apple podcast. The username is ACR1066. Did something happen in 1066?
I don't have a clue.
The Battle of Hastings. The Battle of Hastings was 1066, I think.
I don't know what that is, so I'll take your word for it.
Well, it's a battle that happened in Hastings.
We have a street called Hastings in Vancouver, so...
Which was probably named after Hastings, where there was a battle in 1066. But that's not what this lovely person writes in to say. They say, "A must listen the day it arrives. 5 stars. When I see a episode drop of Spy Hards, it immediately goes to the top of the list for a listen. I thought I was a spy film fan prior to listening, but now I know there is such a deeper world. Thanks, Scott and Cam, for sharing so many hidden gems."
Thank you so much. I am just tickled at the fact that someone sees The Adventures of Tartu pop up in their podcast feed and is like, "That is a must listen right this second."
He's the mystery man of the Balkans. How could you not?
Exactly. Right. And so, yes, thank you very much for that very kind review. And as for your code name, I mean, it's obviously going to tie into this week's film. And what else could it be but Iron Bark?
Oh, it had to be Iron Bark, didn't it? What a great name that they didn't use to name this film.
Exactly. So that is a pretty distinct and memorable code name, I think.
Absolutely. Enjoy your new code name. Use it in public. Change your name legally. Make it your passport. I don't know, but do something with it because it's a special thing that only you have now, Ironbark.
Maybe don't travel to Russia and mention your code name is Ironbark, though. That might not go great.
Yeah, we don't really want that to be on us, of course. This is not real advice. We're just two fictional podcast spies out in the world, you know.
Exactly, yes.
Exactly. Well, get your 5-star Apple Podcast reviews in to Apple Podcasts and we'll read them out. You'll become a Spy Hards Die Hard too, and you'll be the next Iron Bark. But without further ado, let's get to the review. Okay, here we are, folks. It's time to talk about this week's film. But before we get there, we need to introduce our very special guest, making his triumphant second appearance on Spy Hards podcast. We pulled him out of the gulag. It is Mr. Ian Sanders from the Cold War Conversations podcast. Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you very much. Honored to have a return fixture with you. I must have done all right in the previous chat we had about Bridge of Spies, but looking forward to diving into The Courier.
It's an interesting one because there's a lot of connective tissue between the two films. That's mm-hmm. one of the reasons why your name popped out in my head when we were looking at tackling this film. And obviously your podcast ties in very beautifully to this too. But also, I just think it's been a little while and we had a good time last time. And I want to sort of check in and see how you've been as well. It's been a couple of years since we did Bridge of Spies. What's been new with Cold War Conversations?
Wow, a couple of years ago, that long ago. Cold War Conversations has been going from strength to strength now at something like 333 episodes.
Wow.
Loads of interesting guests that I've had on recently. I had a East German tank commander Trying to get more content from the other side of the hill, the Warsaw Pact countries. Obviously, getting hold of Russians now is not so easy, but there's all those other satellite countries to have a go at. And in fact, tomorrow I've got a really good spy story. I've got the story of John Vassal, who was worked in the Admiralty in London and was recruited by the KGB, or coerced to work for the KGB whilst he was at the British Embassy in Moscow. So no shortage of spy stories over at Cold War Conversations.
And just for those who maybe haven't tuned into the Bridge of Spies episode, what can people expect over on Cold War Conversations?
Well, it's interviews with people who lived through and experienced the Cold War. So I do have interviews with KGB spies, people who work for the Stasi, as well as CIA. British people who work for British intelligence are still very reticent to speak on the record, but there's a wide range of stories there. I do quite a number of author interviews. In fact, my interview next Saturday is with an author who's written a book about John Vassal. But I have got an interview which I haven't published yet, which is with somebody who was a friend of Rudolf Abel. Who was the Bridge of Spies spy. Mm. And he was a good friend of his. He was a fellow artist who worked with him at the same artist studio. And it's a fascinating interview. And I did record that one on video. And at one point in the interview, he said, "Oh, would you like to see some of the paintings I did of Willie?" Because he had at the time, but he turned up with this portrait. He came back and showed me this portrait of Rudolf Abel in the artist studio. Unbelievable.
That's crazy. It's always great when guests come prepared with things like that. I'll never forget the time we had Nicky Norday on the show, who's a sort of master stunt man who did the hand-to-hand combat scene with Matt Damon and Jason in The Bourne Identity. And he just, in the middle of the conversation, just pulled out the push dagger that he tried to kill Jason Bourne with. He's like, "Yeah, I took it from the shoot." Great, cool. What a weird thing to bring, but hey, we got to see it.
Brilliant, brilliant. Yeah, you never know what a guest is going to turn up with.
And you never know what you're going to get on Cold War Conversations.
Right.
Exactly. Well, you're always going to get quality. That's what you can be assured of.
You're damn right. And I was actually going to ask, you know, Ian, you have now over 300 episodes. Are there any, like, stories or interview subjects that are kind of on your bucket list? Like, the ones that are still kind of keeping you up at night? Like, I need to track this down.
Mikhail Gorbachev was on my bucket list until he moved on.
Right.
Yeah.
Lech Walesa, the leader of the Free Trade Union in Poland in 1980. I'd love to be able to speak to him, although I don't think he speaks English, so that would be through a translator. I've been watching this new series on Netflix, Turning Point, The Cold War and the Bomb. Mm-hmm. And there's some great interviews on there. And one of the people they've interviewed is Gorbachev's translator.
Wow, okay.
Who you often see in a lot of the footage. And I've got an interview with the director of that documentary series, which should be coming out next Wednesday. And one of the questions I'm going to ask him is, can he get me in contact with Gorbachev's translator?
If you don't ask, you don't get.
Yeah, yeah. But in some ways, the stories that I really like are the unknown ones. I mean, it's not unusual for me to have a guest say something along the lines of, "You know what? I've not told anybody this story before. I've not shared these details, even with my family." And it's amazing. You know, when I started doing the podcast, I didn't really think how powerful and how moved I would be by some of the stories that I record. And it's a real honor to, you know, record these and share them with the wider audience and, you know, ensure they're preserved for posterity.
It's an interesting one, because I think when you last came on the show and when we've had chats outside of recording episodes, you sort of postulated Cold War Conversations as preserving a slice of history, and that's what the show does. And it really actually changed my, at least my perspective on how we do our interviews as well, because it's all well and good speaking to people who worked on, you know, like Denise Richards, we mentioned earlier, worked on a Bond film. She's done plenty of press interviews, and most of those stories we got, most of them had been published before. But there's a lot of the screenwriters that we've had or directors that really have never been approached about the work that they've done, or they've done much more famous pieces, but we're asking them about a spy film they did very early in their career. No one ever talks to them about. And so I always like to approach it now as us preserving their stories, because they're not getting told either until we have those conversations.
Absolutely. I mean, you're preserving movie history with every interview you do, because, you know, no interview is the same.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you're probably a bit like me. You know, I'm always waiting for a guest to say something along the lines of, I'd not thought about that.
Mm.
Oh, yeah, let me tell you about this. And you mm-hmm. think, this is great, because this is unrehearsed. They've not done this before. And they're telling us something new, or some new insight that perhaps they haven't shared before.
That's the goal. That's the dream. But we've brought you back for a very special assignment. You teased it earlier with the name of the film, but I'm going to throw it to Cam for the official announcement. What are we talking about this week, Cam?
Yes, we are talking about The Courier, starring Benedict Cumberbatch. It's listed as a 2020 film, but that's because it played in some film festivals. It was actually released in 2021.
Okay, I thought we'd covered it in 2020, but I guess it was a 2021 declassified episode.
It was, yeah.
Hmm, interesting. Okay, well, if you haven't seen The Courier, it was it's on most, I think, a lot of PVOD around the world. It is here in the UK, but here is your synopsis. And this might be the shortest synopsis I've ever read. Wow, this is literally two lines. Here we go. The Courier, based on the incredible true story of a Welsh businessman turned spy.
And that's it?
That's it.
Okay, well, there you have it.
Let me see if I... Oh, wow, it's actually even shorter on IMDb. I'll give you a little bit more. Businessman Greville Wynne is asked by a Russian source to try and help put an end to the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Okay, at least that's a little specific about the time period and the events that it transpires around.
I guess so. It's a tease.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that's necessarily true. Because the Cuban Missile Crisis hasn't really happened at the point that the... But anyway, I'm being pedantic.
It's okay. We didn't write these synopses.
No, I know.
None of us are to blame. We can blame the person who wrote them. But I did just sort of say before, we did cover this film on a declassified episode many moons ago, back in 2021. So we do have our initial thoughts there if you want to travel back and hear some of those. So I won't belabor the point with Cam and I talking about our first experiences with The Courier, but I am interested to hear from you, Ian, as you are the master of all things Cold War. Did you stumble upon this film when it came out, and so what were your thoughts of it back then?
I had somehow picked up on the fact they were going to release it, but they were, at the time I picked up on it, the film was called Ironbark.
Mm.
That was the original title, which was the code name, I think, for the information that the KGB or the GRU spy was passing over, was Ironbark. And I think that probably the marketing department decided that's not, doesn't really grab people. We need something a bit more enticing. And so went for the Courier, and probably people thought it was about people on bikes delivering packages around London.
I mean, if you go by like literal translations, Ironbark to me just sounds like a really bad Iron Man spinoff.
Yeah.
Well, I also think like Ironbark makes a much better hashtag for online, like hashtag Ironbark versus hashtag The Courier.
Yeah.
I suppose if you're going for the Instagrammable names, but yeah, Ironbark to me just sounds like a kid's film I wouldn't want to watch.
Yeah.
They obviously weren't that interested in pursuing Gen Z.
No, I don't think this film is aimed at Gen Z or Gen Alpha now.
Sure.
Well, Cam, I'm curious. I need to know, how did we get the message? How did we get The Courier?
Right. So we're going to keep the behind the scenes a little bit less in depth than usual. And maybe, Scott, you want to explain to the audience why that is?
Oh, you've really thrown me under the bus there, because I wasn't prepared to make this sweeping statement, but This week we're having quite the courier special. We're doing two Spymaster interviews for you. First and foremostly, later this week, we're joined by the screenwriter of this film, Mr. Tom O'Connor, and he gives us the complete behind the scenes of how this film was envisioned and brought to life by himself. And later this week, we are also joined by the director of the film, Mr. Dominic Cook, who expands on that story even more and gives us the complete behind the scenes beat-by-beat breakdown of how The Courier was made. So that's probably why Cam is saving his voice and not giving you the full rundown of how we got here.
Yes, and those interviews have been recorded already, so we know how in-depth they are in their explanations as to the journey and the evolution of this story. So they can actually state the facts versus, you know, my research version. So that'll be very good listening, I think.
I think so. And yeah, they're both very passionate about the film. They both put a lot of work into it. So I'd recommend if you're a fan of The Courier or a fan of sort of Cold War movies, check them both out later this week.
Yes, definitely.
I'll definitely be listening to those.
I mean, it was an absolute pleasure to take part in them. And so, yeah, I think this is going to be some great stuff for the listeners.
It's interesting. We haven't done sort of the double bill since The Avengers, I think back in 2021 when we tackled the 90s film, doing the screenwriter and the director in the same week. So it's been a while since we've done that.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. That's an odd pairing.
Three episodes in the week. Yeah, it is. It is. The Avengers and The Courier. They've got the...
Both set around the 60s, so they've got that going for them.
I mean, one doesn't feature Sean Connery making puns about getting wet.
That's true. That's true. I thought that was very strange when that happened in The Courier. But anyways. So The Courier, or Ironbark as it began sort of its life, was written by Tom O'Connor, who Scott mentioned earlier. And it was pretty early in his career. He'd done in 2012 an action film called Fire with Fire with Josh Duhamel, Rosario Dawson, and Bruce Willis. And I never really heard too much about this movie. I think it was maybe a direct-to-video release because it didn't play in theaters here, at least in my neck of the woods. But it was actually 2017's The Hitman's Bodyguard that put O'Connor on the map. And obviously that movie spawned a sequel as well. But it was really following up The Hitman's Bodyguard that led into The Courier. And so I'm going to let him talk all about how that actually happened in the interview. But that's basically some context as to who the writer of the film is. Mm-hmm. And notably an American writer as well, which you might not think watching The Courier. So he'll talk a bit about that as well, and perhaps how that informed the storytelling that transpires in the film.
Yeah, because it's an interesting thing we get into in the interview, but we could just talk about for a second, is this film doesn't feel particularly Americanized. I mean, using it as a counterpoint, say, Bridge of Spies, that feels like a very American film. This feels like it's from the same mold of things like Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, which actually wasn't directed by a Brit, but still has that sort of British pessimism to it.
Sure, yeah, which you bring every single week.
Right, that's the magic.
That's right.
That I rain down on you.
Well, it's a very British story. I mean, there's very few American characters in it, and you don't really get much more British than the Greville Wynn character.
I mean, the name alone. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's in a gentleman's club or whatever they used to call those things at the beginning. He's playing golf. He is schmoozing people with port and brandy. And it feels very much of that ilk that I will never be part of.
No, with that attitude. So the movie was directed by Dominic Cook, who will also be obviously joining us on the show. But he's an English writer-director who started out just as a TV runner, and then kind of found his place, which was in theater. And he started a theater company called Panoptic, and he ran that for 2 years, and then became an assistant director at the Royal Shakespearean Company. And going forward, bounced between the Royal Shakespearean Company and the Royal Court Theater, and over the course of his career, has won 5 Olivier Awards for productions that he did of The Crucible, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, and Follies. And he's currently, I believe, adapting Follies for the big screen. It's going to be his latest film, if it happens. He was also actually in 2014 appointed the Commander of the Order of the British Empire for his work in drama. So a very, very esteemed and respected theater director here.
And I will just jump in because I can hear you all writing emails to us now. It's the Royal Shakespeare Company. Cam is just wrong.
That's embarrassing as an English major. So
it really is. You love Shakespeare. You've got his entire works in your house. I don't think I've read an entire Shakespeare all the way through, and I know that.
We did go to the Globe, though, when I was in London.
I almost fell asleep. Moving on.
Yes, as I recall. Yes. So Dominic Cook, in terms of being, you know, directing TV and film, he worked on a National Theatre live production of Comedy of Errors, which would have been a televised version, version of the play that he would stage that was actually shown in theaters. Mm-hmm. He also did 3 episodes of the Hollow Crown series, and then led into a 2017 drama he made called On Chesnail Beach, starring Saoirse Ronan and Billy Howie. And that movie didn't make too much of a mark, but that led into The Courier, which was, I think, a little more noticed when it came out.
I think they certainly wanted it to be more noticed when it came out. I think we'll get into that conversation in a minute. But this film is very much a COVID-19 victim.
Sure, yes. I will say, though, like, The Courier, there was awareness in North America about it, whereas I would say On Chesnail Beach didn't really cross the pond.
I don't think it crossed many ponds or roads, because I've never heard of it either.
Okay, well, that's fair.
Sorry, is that spelled C-H-E-S-N-I-L?
It is, yes.
Is that not Chesil Beach?
Oh,
yes. Come on, Ian. Get in there. It's Correcting Cam Day. This episode is now brought to you by Correcting Cam.
You know, one day I'm going to be able to correct you guys on, like, Canadian pronunciations for something or other.
Well, you guys don't, like, spell things weirdly. We have stuff like Worcestershire sauce.
It's true, yeah.
You'll never have that. No. Nor would you want it.
No, we do have, like, places like Tawasin. So there's that, you know, some interesting spellings.
Nanaimo, that's a weird one.
Yeah, sure, yeah. Mm. So, yeah, as we said, this movie began its life as Iron Bark and then was changed to The Courier. And we'll get into the reasons for that with actually the writer in particular. So in terms of the production budget, I couldn't find it anywhere online, but it would not have been big budget. It, as Scott said, was released during the pandemic. So when we actually reviewed it on the show, it was because it was a, you know, on-demand release. Mm. It was released in a few theaters in the UK. Over here in North America, not so much. And so, like, domestically, it did, in North America, it did $6.6 million, international $19.4 million, for a worldwide total of $26 million worldwide. Again, people were not really rushing out to the theaters at this point in time, so that really is no comment whatsoever on the movie's quality or whether people actually enjoyed it or not. And for that year, it landed number 101 at the box office between Chaos Walking, which was the Daisy Ridley, Tom Holland sci-fi film.
That film has a hilarious history, by the way. If anyone wants to look up Chaos Walking, that film was shot in like 2016, I think, and it went through so many reshoots. They tried to bin it. Mm-hmm. Funny film to read about, not a fun film to watch.
Yeah, and this landed one spot above Spencer, which was the Princess Diana story with Kristen Stewart.
Oh, okay. Right.
Mm. Yeah, very dark and depressing film. I saw it in theaters.
Poor bedfellows right there, I'd say.
Yeah, not exactly a great pairing. And the top 3 for the year. Number 1 was Spider-Man No Way Home. Number 2 was The Battle at Lake Changjin. And number 3 was Hi Mom. The latter two are Chinese productions that, you know, obviously box office was a little outside the norm when it came to the pandemic era, where Chinese theaters were showing a lot of movies and actually having audiences show up. Not really the case in North America and much of the UK and Europe.
For sure. I mean, just speaking to that sort of COVID-19 situation for a moment, I don't think this film would have pulled me back into theaters even if it was shown around here. I think my first film back was Tenet,
yeah,
during COVID-19, but that was a big marquee release, like that demanded to be seen on the big screen. I wouldn't say The Courier necessarily has to be seen on the big screen.
No, and also it took quite a while to lure back older moviegoers, mm-hmm, who would have been more of the prime audience for this film. Like, you're not going to get as many 20-year-olds showing up to see The Courier, but like, they had a real problem for, it was about 2 years, putting out, say, R-rated films or more serious dramas and actually having anyone show up.
Well, just throwing it to you, Ian, for a second, do you recall your first trip back to the theaters after COVID?
I don't, actually. I'm not a big moviegoer. I'm much more comfortable watching it on a big screen at home, to be honest. The Courier may well have tempted me out. I think I'm part of that demographic that Cam described there. So the trailer I thought was really strong with it. And I was, you know, seriously thinking about going and seeing it at the pictures. And then it came on pay-per-view and I thought, you know, why bother?
Mm. Did you actually, that's a good question, because I was sent, or Cam and I did the classified episode, so we were sent screeners of the film. We didn't have to pay for it. But Ian, did you find yourself paying for it in the end? Did you do the sort of PVOD system?
I think it was either on Netflix or Amazon Prime. So I'd already got those subscriptions. So it wasn't a, you know, pay-per-view per se. It was already in the bundle for that particular channel.
There was that sort of moment, wasn't there, where the PVOD was really important, because you had stuff like, there was a couple of Disney films that went straight to PVOD, like Black Widow, I think, did that, Day and Date.
Black Widow did simultaneous.
Yeah.
Mulan, I don't remember if that was simultaneous. They may have just gone PVOD with Mulan.
I think they did. I think that was straight to Disney Plus, but you had to pay money for it.
Yeah, and the thing about The Courier is, I would guess it probably wasn't hugely successful on PVOD. It feels like a movie that needs more of like an Amazon or a Netflix or something, like a streaming model, to really grab eyeballs. I just don't know, like, when you present a list of movies that people pay for, if they're as likely to buy something like The Courier versus a Mulan or a Black Widow.
Well, it doesn't have that sort of water cooler urgency to it. Like, it doesn't feel like you have to see it, like back when Marvel was important, for instance, where you had to see the latest Marvel film in the first weekend so you can go to work the next week and talk about, oh, guess what Thor did in CG, blah blah blah. It doesn't have that moment necessarily, so yeah, maybe it being on Netflix or Amazon, it is its perfect home.
And you just see Benedict Cumberbatch and you're gonna have a certain segment of audience members who are gonna go, oh, I'd like to see things because I like him.
It's the Penguins guy.
Exactly, exactly, yes.
But it's interesting, you know, I think this is like our second time doing it declassified and going into a full review after that.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see sort of the conversation continue about this film. People have sort of caught up with it since. It had that sort of lull on release because of things like COVID and the world ending and bits and bobs like that. But I think since then, spy movie fans have caught up with this film because, I mean, I put out a post about it the other day and had a lot of warm responses to it. A lot of people really, really enjoyed this film.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is, I think, more out there. Even I picked up the Blu-ray at my local library and they had several copies. So there's a segment of the audience that is just going to pick it up that way as well. It feels like there's a lot of movies that you and I have covered on Declassified that were perhaps streaming releases or whatever that just disappeared down the void, whereas I feel like The Courier actually still is getting play
without remorse. What happened to that film?
It's getting a sequel apparently, so who knows.
I can't wait for that. But Ian, I'll just ask you then, because obviously you're part of this the Cold War world. I know obviously the podcast deals with the real life situations and spies, but yeah, you have a great Facebook group. A lot of conversations happening there and a lot of listeners and a lot of engagement. Does this film ever sort of pop up in conversation when you're talking about Cold War films?
It doesn't especially. It's generally not that much discussion about films in our group. I can't remember when this, you know, whether during COVID. I'm sure we would have discussed it because I would have put the trailer up in the Facebook group. But And I think it's a good depiction of that time. As with any Hollywood movie, they take shortcuts in order to smooth out timelines and just make it easier to follow for a general audience. But, you know, I always think with any of these sort of films, and as well as Bridge of Spies, is that if it gets people more interested in this period of history, then that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. You know, even if they take some liberties with the story, people will generally, if they're fascinated by it, Google it more and do further investigation and actually find out more about the story and hopefully end up on Cold War conversations as well.
Well, I'll be interested to hear from your listeners what they think of the film when we put this episode out. It'd be an interesting conversation, but a lot of people who have a lot of knowledge about what really happened, applying it to sort of this slightly heightened world of the film. And speaking of The Courier, I think it's time to talk about the film. Cam and I have already sort of shared some of our thoughts. So Ian, I want to throw it to you first. You're our guest. You've sat down, you've watched The Courier for us. What do you think of The Courier?
I like it. I think it's got a really good period feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Cumberbatch's Greville Wynn, I mean, if you've actually seen photos of Greville Wynn, he looks the part. I think he carries off from what I know of Greville Wynn and some of the TV footage or film footage there is of Greville Wynn speaking. He's done a lot of work around the character, as you would expect with Benedict Cumberbatch, and he really goes in for the hardcore. I've been in a Soviet prison for quite a few months look later on in the film, which I'm sure we'll discuss as well. But I think, you know, they've gone to a lot of effort to get the details right. So the plane that he's, the airliner that they use is a British airliner of that period, a Vickers Viscount. So that, you know, they haven't just used any old aircraft or taken shortcuts there. Generally, it covers the story really well. It follows more or less the storyline. There's a few bits that it, as I said, it sort of abbreviates. But I really enjoyed it. And watching it another time, you know, watching it again, I thought, actually, this is even better than what I thought it was the last time I watched it.
Well, I had a question for you, Ian, because you've covered so many Cold War stories over the course of your podcast. Like, how familiar were you with this story?
I was quite familiar with it because I did do an episode on Penkovsky, the GRU Soviet spy. So I was familiar with it. And also the story sort of starts in the same year as the shoot down of Gary Powers. So there, as you said, Scott, there's a direct link with Bridge of Spies here because it's exactly the same period. You know, there's some bits that they abbreviate because it's not always clear as to how Penkovsky is sort of caught in the end. You know, you've got that surveillance of him.
Yeah.
But the actual truth of the matter is that there was a British spy called George Blake that was working for the KGB, and he revealed that somebody at the British embassy was actually MI6. So the Soviets trailed this guy and his wife, and it turned out his wife was the person who was receiving the information from Penkovsky. She was basically wandering around Moscow with her child in a pram. She'd meet up with Penkovsky and he'd drop the documents into the pram. Mm. And I don't think that's apparent in the film.
No, it's interesting. Like, there's definitely a movie you could make out of this story that would be much more of like a procedural or much more of like the fly on the wall observation of the events. And it's very, like, I think when you watch the movie, very clear that they were much more interested in the relationships than kind of the even what could feel like the Wikipedia greatest hits.
Yeah, because I mean, it's a bit of a comedy of error. I mean, when Penkovsky first tries to contact the Americans, first of all, he basically approaches a couple of American students in Moscow and hands them a package and says, take that to the US embassy. And of course, they're thinking, oh, we're being set up here. But eventually one of them believes him and takes the package to the US embassy. The CIA think it's a trick for quite some time. And then eventually they think, well, actually, yeah, let's try and contact this guy. They make a real mess of it. And then they get the British involved because they know the British are more experienced in running agents in Moscow. And that's really where the downfall starts, because obviously there's this leak within MI6 with George Blake, who then tells the Soviets about this person in the British embassy who's working for MI6. The backstory, there's a load more detail that is a really interesting spy story in itself. So I would recommend people to look at that because there's a really interesting story behind it.
It's always tough when you've got a film based on real events, especially real events when we don't know all of the answers, because it's hidden behind all these closed doors of, you know, classified documents and things like that, and people being scrubbed out of history, because you kind of have to fill in the blanks yourself. And I tip my hat to anyone who can bring a film in that's this good in my book, which I'll get to in a minute, and it make it feel believable and realistic at the same time, but also entertaining. And maybe I'll just sort of segue, Cam, if you don't mind, into my thoughts about it.
Swing away.
I do love this film. I had a lot of... I think I was moderately pleased with it when we first watched it, but this second time watching it, I think I spent a lot more time focusing on the character work and how they build that up. And I think it's such a masterstroke to... Because I know I could... I'm not an expert like Ian is. Ian, you know the story very well, so you can kind of compare the reality to the fiction here and find out what is really happening and compare and contrast. I don't know much about that side of things, so I'm looking at it more as a piece of film.
You're an expert on Condor Man. So unless he's soaring through the sky, then, you know...
That's all I've got. Michael Crawford is the man, but we're not here to talk about our flying, spying, death-defying man of the hour. It's so smart to base this story on an everyman. You know, he is your gateway into this world. He is me. He is you. He is the listener, you guys at home. He is plucked out of just living his normal life with his wife and kid and sent off to be a spy in Russia at the height of the Cold War, and it's the scariest thing you could do. I cannot imagine what Greville was going through during actually doing this in real life. And I think Benedict Cumberbatch is a masterstroke when it comes to casting, but I think he's also held up by a wonderful cast of people around him. I'm going to be the first person to take a punt at saying the guy's name, Merab Nanitzi. I can't pronounce that very well, I'm sorry. But Rachel Brosnahan is also fantastic. There's just a great cast. Angus Wright is in there too. Jess Buckley is fantastic. And I mean, I've got my criticisms, which I'll get to in a bit. But I just think if you're looking for one of those sort of reality-based, Cold War-esque spy films that really go with the nitty-gritty of spycraft, but are entertaining at the same time, I can't pick many better than this.
Well, you mentioned how it has a lot of parallels with Bridge of Spies, and you can really see that. But the thing that I think you kind of cued in on something there, which is you said he's an everyman. And Tom Hanks is kind of like an everyman, but that character, that real person, obviously, who took part in the events of Bridge of Spies, not really an everyman. Like,
no?
Incredibly successful lawyer, somewhat of a public figure, and, you know, this diplomat being sent in, that's very different than a guy who's basically a salesman being sent into, you know, a world he really doesn't understand. Like, Tom Hanks's character in that film somewhat understands what he has to do. He understands diplomacy and how to talk to people, even if the situation around him is intense. Whereas, like, that is something that I think really works for the career, which is, like, this is a real fish out of water, and he has no idea what's going on half the time. You know, it's the CIA and MI6 basically saying what they're going to do and telling him, don't worry about it, we'll figure it out.
And there's a moment later in the film, you know, we've alluded to Benedict Cumberbatch's character being put into a Russian prison and tortured, and we'll talk about that, I'm sure. But the moment where he's picked up on the plane and he's saying, oh, nothing. Why are you picking me up? I didn't do anything wrong, and he's taken off the plane. That moment is the scariest moment in the entire film, because he is completely without power in that situation. He has no skills to cope with it. He has not had years and years of MI6 training on how to cope with torture or anything. He is just, it's you or me at the airport, picked out of a line by security, taken off to a back room. We don't know what's going to happen to us. We're completely powerless in that moment, and that's terrifying.
Well, what I love about that moment, too, is obviously he sees, you know, the police coming to get him, but also the guy sitting behind him is also part of the arrest. So it's like he's surrounded by people who are going to arrest him. Like, there's no friendly faces.
There's no way out.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really enjoyed it. Cam, what about you?
I really enjoyed this movie a lot as well. And I think it does a fantastic job in a very unflashy way at condensing a multi-year story into a two-hour package that is still compelling and doesn't feel choppy. Mm-hmm. You can get to the end and go, oh, they traded like 5,000 documents or something like that. I didn't really feel like they were passing that many documents over the course of this movie, but it doesn't really matter because they, I think, succeed so well in nailing the core relationships that inform the entire story. I think like the friendship between the two men, you know, the salesman and this, you know, Russian who is passing the secrets back and forth, it's all grounded in things that are entirely recognizable to pretty much anyone watching the movie. It's them talking about their families, their home lives, you know, their aspirations for what they'd like the world to be like. These are all things that anyone could relate to watching the movie. And I think it does an incredibly good job at making that friendship count in about 45 minutes of screen time. And that's 45 minutes intercut with marital storylines, what's going on with MI6 and the CIA. You know, there's a lot of other business going on around it. And yet, the building of that relationship over 45 minutes or so has to carry you through the entire second half of the movie, where Benedict Cumberbatch really takes the spotlight and you get the prison visit and things like that. It is, I think, really impactful. It's not just the performance by Mareb Nanichi, but also like the way that character just looms over the whole movie. Right?
Yeah.
And I know I probably mangled that name, but there's going to be a lot of mangling of his name, and he deserves to have his name mentioned as many times as possible, because while Benedict Cumberbatch may be the star of the movie, I think he's the secret weapon that makes the movie work.
Just keep a counter, guys, listening at home, how many times we mispronounce his name, and then let us know, drop us an email, see how many you can count, how many times we mispronounce his name. I want to hear Ian have a go at it too.
I'm not even going to go there. I'm sticking with Merab. He's fine. No, he is brilliantly cast in this. I mean, I've as you'd imagine Penkovsky to be. I mean, I've not seen any footage of him speak. There are some photos of him, and there's certainly a likeness there. And I think it comes across, you know, pretty well. I mean, for Penkovsky, I mean, he was doing this really for ideological reasons. He wanted to work for the West, and he wanted to become a officer of either the British Army or the US Army. But he was also a bit of a loose cannon. Mm. He was difficult to handle as an agent as well. Because he, you know, when he had the meetups in London, you know, he would be out, you know, around the nightclubs and stuff like that. And I think that there was some confusion when he was being interrogated by the KGB. They'd recorded a conversation that he'd had in a restaurant with Greville Wynne. Where Penkovsky had said to Wynne, "How's Zeff?" And the KGB were very mystified by this conversation because they thought this must be a code name for somebody. And it turned out it was some girl that Penkovsky had met in a nightclub. And he was asking Greville Wynne how she was. Was she still doing all right in London?
Oh, no, not the wholesome family man I'm seeing in the movie.
I do appreciate a little bit of character they give to Penkovsky, because he talks about how he wants to move to Montana.
Yeah.
And basically be a cowboy, which I love that image of Mareb just riding around on a horse being a cowboy. But I was reminded of Sam Neill's character in Hunt for Red October, who also wanted to.
Yeah. I was going to say that there.
There we go. He wanted to move to Montana and be a cowboy. So I think that's just a little nod to spy movie history there. Or maybe that was his plan. I don't know.
Wasn't that the same year, too, that Benedict Cumberbatch played a cowboy in Power of the Dog?
Maybe. I think it was. Are we going back to horse cards all of a sudden?
I think we are.
Throwback. Throwback. Let's talk about some more likes, things that we really liked about the films. Ian, I'm going to throw it to you. Something you want to call out, a scene, a character, a performance, a moment that you really liked.
I think that the moment that I really like, and it is sort of like the everyman piece in there, is when he is first recruited, when he sits down for that dinner and he says, "You want me to be a spy?" And you know, it's almost like, and you can sort of understand it, you know, it's exciting to think that you would be a spy. But obviously the implications of you said, you know, previously about what might happen if you get captured. But he's got this implicit trust that MI6 will pull the irons out of the fire at the last minute, or ride over the hill with the cavalry, or rescue him. And he's got this naivety as to exactly what he's getting into there.
Well, I love that, you know, initially he's like, this sounds dangerous. And they say something like, if this were dangerous, you'd be at home right now. Like, they're, I think, really underselling the potential threats of this. And I think it's done in a way that is actually really almost like amusing, but also like you're like, oh, this poor guy.
I think he's been reading too many, like, at this point, Ian Fleming, maybe, or maybe some Graham Greene spy novels, and just got an idea in his head as to what a spy is like. And he's hoping he's being sent off with a DB5 to drive around. Actually, it wouldn't be a DB5 in the Fleming books, but sent to, you know, gallivant around Europe and shag his way through a nest of spies somewhere. But that is not the mission he is sent on.
No, and I mean, also, there's the moment, too, where they realize that Penkovsky is in trouble, and he's like, use me, send me in. But it's like, really, what is this guy going to do?
Let me at him.
Yeah, I think he's in a little over his head.
Yeah, he's got that sort of take. I mean, the problem is, and it's actually something I'll come to and dislikes maybe in a little while, but it's that classic spy movie cliche of they become a spy and then are instantly fantastic at being a spy.
Is he, though?
Well, it does it 5,000 documents later.
But he's not really a spy, right? Like, they're just kind of like exchanging documents back and forth.
And he, in the real story, he's not doing the heavy lifting with the document exchange. It's this woman whose husband is in MI6 with the pram.
Yeah.
Who's doing a lot of the document exchanges.
Well, I guess they've amalgamated that for the film, but I think that is a great scene, though, that restaurant scene, and getting an idea of how they're manipulating him as well, how there's a slight bit of them twisting his arm without him knowing it, and it doesn't really wink at the audience either. You kind of are pulled along with it, but you know that there are higher stakes than, oh, don't worry, we'll pull you out, it'll be no problem.
And I think, like, you know, you have Rachel Brosnahan in that scene as the CIA member who's obviously involved in this. And we talked to the writer about that character because it is a composite character of several individuals who are tied to the real events. And they made a real artistic choice with actually having a female character take that place in the movie. But I think this movie does an incredibly good job at writing a composite character who actually feels like an interesting and compelling individual. Mm-hmm. We don't know a ton about her, but I was consistently engaged with where she was involved throughout the story, and, you know, has a great scene with Jesse Buckley later in the movie as well. And I mean, a lot of movies, Scott, that we have covered have very bland composite characters that stick out like a sore thumb because you're like, this feels like a fake person.
Well, they could really sort of hedge their bets and not really run with it. But you get someone like Brosnahan in, especially with her Miss Maisel pedigree, and she's used to doing period sort of comedies and dramas. She knows what she's doing in this era. She knows what she's portraying. And I think she really gets the assignment. I remember watching the Ipcress File TV show by ITV a year or so ago, and they've sort of really boosted up the Jean character in that show, to the point of stretching credulity a little bit, and you can feel it falling apart that she's given all this extra stuff. That's not the case here. Rachel Brosnahan's character feels completely at home in this story. I know that in reality it was all just male CIA people working on this case. There wasn't really any women involved at all. But changing it to a woman means it doesn't matter to me. It gives you more representation. It actually gives you that wonderful scene with Jess Buckley later as well. I think you wouldn't get that without this character being a woman. So I think it paid off in the end.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, this isn't a documentary. It's supposed to be entertaining. And I think her contributions actually kind of increase the entertainment factor.
I agree. I think if I'm going to jump on over to a thing I like, I have an idea what Cam's answer is going to be, so I'm going to let that be and let you do that one.
Okay. I don't know if that's accurate, but we'll see.
Okay. Well, I'm really rolling the dice here. But I just actually wanted to tip my hat to two things, and this is really coming under the umbrella of the look and feel of the film. Because the cinematography, who I should have the name of the cinematographer ready, I won't, I'll vamp whilst I look it up. But, you know, the cinematography is fantastic, but also the sort of costuming and the sets are great. And this is done, I mean, none of this is filmed in Russia. It's all just sort of done in post, that stuff there. A lot of it's shot in the UK. The cinematographer is Sean Bobbitt, by the way, just added name in there. But they really capture that feel that I think also Bridge of Spies is very successful at doing. And I imagine this was done far cheaper than Bridge of Spies was.
Yeah, significantly. That's a Spielberg production. They had a little more money to play with for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, it looks the part, specifically like the houses. Both of their houses just feel real and lived in. Everything just feels like, almost like they had some people on set who knew what that era looked like and could really say from experience, perhaps, what the offices should feel like, what the meeting should feel like, what the home should feel like. Nothing felt out of place. I mean, I'm not saying I was, you know, some films have, you know, iPods lying around or something like that. But it just felt like they spent a lot of time making sure that the vibe was right so you could be drawn into the world more.
Yeah.
Well, the cinematographer, Sean Bobbitt, who you mentioned, actually works with Steve McQueen quite a bit and worked on 12 Years a Slave and Shame. So he's pretty visually accomplished. And I'm pretty sure he's an Oscar nominee, if not for 12 Years a Slave, or a couple other things. I love the shot. At one point you have kind of setting up the home life of Greville. And you see him and his wife in the separate rooms.
Yeah.
And you see him in like the lounge and then her in the kitchen. And the way those two rooms have their own distinct feel and vibe, and that they are kind of occupying two very different places in the home. And it looks so beautiful. You could frame that shot. And that's not the only shot through the movie that looks that good.
No, for sure. And I'll also note just something I picked up on. They do a real, they put a lot of effort into making the homes of both Greville Wynn and Oleg Penkovsky's character look very similar, because there are these two men that are connected, at least in the film world, maybe not so much in real life, but they're both idealistic men trying to do the right thing for the world. But also their home lives are very similar with how their families are set up, but also how the houses are set up and how they sort of conduct their business day to day. There is a lot of work to go into it to sort of almost provide like a mirror image between the two of them. It's subtle. It doesn't scream at you that they're doing it, but I just think it's a nice touch.
Yeah, I mean, they do a very good job at creating a connection between the two of them. I like how you see them visiting the play, or the ballet, I should say, and how they both have this emotional involvement, but you have like Khrushchev up in the balcony looking over them. So it's kind of like the eyes of Russia are always on top of them, and that's like their only real escape is that, you know, that kind of getting sucked into the ballet.
I think the cinematography is particularly good with this. I mean, it feels right. It feels like they've really got the early 60s captured well. Although I was irritated to see, because I looked for bloopers and stuff like that, and apparently somebody criticized the fact that you could hear a police siren in one scene and the British police only had bells on their squad cars in the 1960s. They didn't have sirens, but you're naturally going to expect that from somebody.
Oh, boo. Disavowed.
Yeah, Chuck, we're canceling the podcast. We're done. I'm sure if I went to the goofs page of IMDb, there'd be some real eye-rolling goofs in there.
There always are.
There always are. Cam, I presumed I knew what you were going to say, but why don't you prove me wrong anyway?
I was going to talk just about the relationships and the way that they are so effectively conveyed.
Bingo.
And we've talked about, obviously, you know, Greville and Oleg, the scenes they have together. You know, I mentioned the ballet, but just the kind of gentle discussions they have about, you know, who they are as people. But then also something that would be completely sidelined or turned into very one-note material, the relationship between Greville and his wife. And I think there's some really clever stuff going on, because Jesse Buckley, you don't cast her and give her just like generic stuff. That's not acceptable. And so I like how she is often too smart for the situation. She's someone who's going, this doesn't add up. And there is, you know, references to him having had an affair in the past. And so she is on to him. And I love the way that she has to play an active role throughout the course of the movie, at a certain point going to the prison to see him. And she has a great moment there where she basically says, it's looking good. You may only have to do another year or two. It's like, oh my God, we've seen what this man has gone through. But there's like a real strength to her and an intelligence. And there are so many movies about men in dramatic historical situations where you have the woman at home. And there's a lot of people that have won Oscars for the woman at home roles. But this one actually feels like one where the writer and the director actively cared about making that a compelling figure.
It feels like a real relationship. You know, you know, you could very easily just soft soap that and just have it almost like as a background piece, but it becomes, you know, it does become a central part of the film, you know, her suspicions about what he's up to. And you know, the inference there that he did have an affair previously.
You could argue that you could take 10 minutes out of this film and really sort of pare down that character, and it maybe the end result would still be the same, but I think it just adds a splash of color to this whole story, knowing that there is a real person behind this spy, knowing that there is a real relationship in there, and that you actually care about what the wife is going through, despite this big, massive stakes of the Cuban Missile Crisis. You care about his wife and their relationship.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Be interesting to, you know, whether, you know, Jesse Buckley looked at that script and thought, yeah, this is something I can really get my teeth into. And if it hadn't have been that script, whether she would have turned it down because it was too, you know, vanilla.
There is a story in our interview with Tom O'Connor late this week about that and how that character came to be. So obviously it's based on a real person, but look out for that. We'll have a bit more information there.
Okay.
I did just want to add in an extra like that no one's mentioned, but we've talked about it a little bit, and I'm assuming it's in everyone's like section. And that is, I mean, I'm not saying I like it, but the Greville being in prison and the treatment there and the physical transformation that Benedict Cumberbatch actually physically went through. It's enhanced with digital effects, but he did drop about 10 kg in weight. I'm not sure what that is in pounds. I'm sorry, North Americans. For this role, he committed to it. It's one of the things that really attracted him to doing this role, was actually getting to do a physical performance like that. And we've seen, much like the sort of wife at home characters, we've seen plenty of torture scenes in spy movies, and there aren't many that leave an impression on me like this one does.
Well, you can look at, you know, Zero Dark Thirty, which has very graphic torture scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And they definitely are revolting to look at, mm-hmm. but this has more of an emotional punch. When you see what this character goes through over that period of time, and what I think is the big gut punch is when you have him sat down in the interrogation room opposite Oleg, and you see what Oleg looks like, and you feel so much for that character, and the fact that they don't specifically tell you what they've been doing to him, which apparently was quite horrific.
I've read some things.
It really sticks with you. Yeah, it really does stick with you in that moment in the movie.
And it's actually quite good in the sense of the trailer, or at least the one I watched today, doesn't really reveal much about what happens to him in the prison. So you do get this physical transformation reveal in the film, and it hits you like, oh, I did not see that coming. I did not know we were going to see him sort of drop all that weight and look so powerless. And there's a real, there's a nice touch that I noticed on my second viewing with Benedict Cumberbatch and push-ups.
Yeah.
You know, early in the film, he's not able to do a push-up. As he gets better at spying, he's actually able to do a few. He's getting stronger. And then as he's in prison, he loses the ability to do a push-up again because he becomes beaten down and weak because of that. And it's just like a showing of his sort of power going up and down and him taking his power away in prison. And I thought that was really nice. And I think that the Jesse Buckley scene was great too. And it reminded me a lot of the BBC adaptation of 1984.
Okay.
Where you see John Hurt go through the torture in the Ministry of Truth, I think it is, in that sequence there. And he doesn't do the whole weight drop thing, but it is quite harrowing to watch that, especially the way they sort of shoot it with the one light dropping down and everything like that. Like it's this is a well put together moment, and I think it will catch people off guard, and it will leave an impression on you.
It's a great moment during the prison sequence where you have like kind of the peephole or whatever in the door, and it's shot through that, and you see Benedict Cumberbatch just melting down inside the room. And like, I remember that moment has like real visceral impact, and it's not, you know, overly graphic or overly intense. It just really conveys the experience that he's going through.
And it's also, it comes back to that everyman view as well. You know, he's not been trained for this. He's not even been told, you know, what to say or anything like, you know, anything like that. And you try and imagine yourself in that situation. You know, and as you say, it starts with being pulled off the plane and then just goes downhill, you know, rapidly and over a long period of time.
I would sing like a canary. They would get everything out of me.
I would not last very long. I mean, I saw the look of that soup in there. I don't know. I think I'm giving it up pretty quick.
I'd be on the plane still. I'd have given it all up just sitting on the plane.
Listen, let's all sit down and talk, shall we? Yeah,
I've got details.
Yeah, let's have a nice cup of tea.
Get your notepads.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special report.
Red Alert, Spyhards, we are shaking things up over on the Patreon page.
That's right, we are launching an exclusive new show where we tackle the exploits of the small screen's greatest secret agents, like Jack Bauer, George Smiley, and beyond.
And don't forget, every month you also get two Agents in the Field episodes where we decode the adventures of your favorite spy actors in their biggest non-spy movies. But Cam, tell the people what we have coming up next.
Well, Scott, in our latest episode of On the Small Screen, we're going to look at 2008's 24 Redemption TV movie. Will Kiefer Sutherland deliver, or will this be a Jack Bauer?
So strap on your Condor Man wings and soar into the future with us over at patreon.com/spyhards.
But before Big O zaps us with a red pulsating laser, let's get back to the spy jinx.
All right, let's move on over to dislikes, things, critiques we have of the film. I have a couple of small ones, but Ian, I'm keen to hear from you first. Is there anything you'd like to sort of pick up about the film?
I don't think so. I've sort of spoken about things because I'm looking at it from the, you know, the real story to see where, you know, where they've done shortcuts and stuff like that. And it sticks really close to the story. It does take a few liberties around the fact, you know, they think that the GRU knew that Penkovsky was a double agent.
Mm-hmm.
For about a year before he was arrested, but they wanted to follow him, and that isn't apparent. It seems like things move very quickly in the film, and I get why they do that. So, you know, I guess that would be my criticism is the, you know, how far away some bits of it are from the truth. But in terms of the general story and the layout of it, it works for me. It's not, you know, I don't think they've taken that many liberties, and they've managed to make a really good drama out of, I would say, probably 90% factual, you know, storyline that they've put together there. Obviously they're making up, you know, the dialogue, because, you know, they won't know that. But there's nothing really major that leaps out that I would criticize about it. I think it's, you know, great casting, great cinematography, and it's Cold War. What's not to like?
Well, that actually does lead me to a question about your sort of Cold War knowledge, because, as you say, you're coming at this from having prior knowledge of the actual real events, or at least some before you watched the film, maybe did some more reading. You've obviously had an episode on one of the characters in this too. When it comes to watching more, you know, Cold War based films, not just spy movies, but films set during the Cold War, Do you find that it's actually harder for you to watch ones that are based on real life events because you find yourself drawing those comparisons? Or do you actually like it when they are based on real events?
Well, I guess it can spoil a film because you know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You know, because you know what the historical side of it is. But then some films do put a twist at the end where it's not, you know, it doesn't actually follow historical fact. Not really. I enjoy most of them. I mean, some of the fiction ones. I mean, you mentioned the ITV Ypres file, which I just didn't like. I just felt it was a bit, they tried too hard to make it look like the 1960s or whenever, you know, the period it was set in. Whereas here, you know, you've got some great performances, some nice understated performances as well. You know, the relationship between them, and that was a very important part of this story, is they built up this really strong friendship. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Wynn says, you know, he would never betray me. He would never betray me. He had that trust in Penkovsky there. And I think it's as accurate as you could do in a film of that story within 2 hours, to be fair.
I had a question for you, Ian, because you came on last time to talk about Bridge of Spies, a movie that has a lot in common with this movie. Mm-hmm. Quality aside or enjoyment aside, which do you think was better at translating kind of the real world story?
I think this was The Courier.
Interesting.
Because it the relationship side, the relationship between the characters is more believable. I mean, with Bridge of Spies, you've got that great relationship with Tom Hanks and Rylance there. I think that works well. But I think you know, the relationship between Greville Wynn and his wife, as you say, and the relationship with Penkovsky, there's some nice nuances in there that I'm not certain you get from Bridge of Spies. I mean, it's difficult. I'm trying to think of bits of the two, but I think because this is the most recent one I've seen of the two, you inevitably, you know, see more details in it that you like or that you dislike. But yeah, I think this one is a more accurate representation of the pressures of being a spy or being involved in espionage.
Mm-hmm. And actually, Bridge of Spies is kind of a mark against that one. It's actually the relationship he has with Amy Ryan in that movie. Mm-hmm. That sort of marriage story really is subpar in comparison to this one. So
yeah.
I love Bridge of Spies. I love it to pieces, but that is definitely an element that falls short in comparison to this one.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And speaking of falling short, I guess I'll chuck my two cents in. I have a bit of an issue with how Penkovsky is handled in this film. I feel like, I mean, not a lot is known about what happened to him at the end. There's a lot of different takes on it. Some say he was just murdered. Some say he was used as something else and put back out to pasture. Some say he just spent the rest of the time in a gulag. There's lots of different interpretations of what happened to the chap. But, you know, once it all goes down and they're captured, the POV really is just Benedict Cumberbatch at that point. And the story seems to sort of want to not talk about Penkovsky much anymore, apart from his reappearance in the prison. But that, for me, is almost more of an interesting part of the story, because much as Benedict Cumberbatch is a fish out of water, he has had none of this training to do anything to sort of survive this environment. We're talking about a man, Penkovsky, who has abandoned his entire country, sold his country out, and will face a very bleak ending, and he knows that. It's Mark Rylance getting into the car at the end of Bridge of Spies. He knows he's going off to a very sorry end, but we don't get to see it or experience it with the character when we spent 45 minutes building up the story about him and his family, about what they all were going through. You never really get a proper resolution on that. And obviously you get the small payoff where he finds out that his actions have stopped the Cuban Missile Crisis. So I could hear you biting back at me and saying there is that little olive branch there. But I don't think you get a character or an actor with the sort of pedigree of Mirab Nenitsky, and I hope I got that right that time, and then don't use him in the torture scenes. I feel like you could have had them both. Like, I could see a shot in my head of both of them back to back on the walls of the prison cells going crazy and having the same reactions to it or something like that. I could just see those sort of things in my head, and I feel like there's a bit of a missed opportunity there that I would have liked to have seen more of.
I wonder if they wanted to have an element of mystery as to what was going on with Penkovsky, that they want the audience to be wondering, like, what's going on with him? Is he going to give up information that could get Benedict Cumberbatch's character of Greville, you know, in trouble? So I think that might be part of the reason, just dramatically, to keep it a mystery. But, like, I also kind of wonder if they underestimated how much the audience would care about the Penkovsky character and actually become emotionally connected to him.
Sure.
Because you have a movie star in Benedict Cumberbatch. And I wonder if they were thinking the audience cares about him. That's who they really genuinely care about. But I almost wonder if they didn't realize that they really had a secret weapon in, you know, the actor playing Penkovsky, where...
Nice. Well done.
Thank you. Thank you. Very smooth, I know.
Is he Prince, the actor formerly known as Penkovsky?
That's right. From now on, yes. I just wonder if they were like, we want a good actor for this role because it's an important role, obviously. But they didn't realize that he would be something of a powerhouse in this movie opposite Benedict Cumberbatch, and people would actually genuinely emotionally want to follow him.
I mean, listen, I think the film resolves perfectly, and I think it's a fine ending. I just, if we're talking about nitpicks, that's something that popped to my mind. I would have liked to have seen a bit more, especially because what is known to him isn't a straight story that we can tell. It is almost a bit ambiguous. Actually gives them a bit of creative license to come up with their own ending for the character, and you could have seen that through to the end, but we just sort of left it to, you know, it's a mystery. I guess that's interesting, but if you're telling a story sort of a, you know, docudrama style that this is going for in a way, maybe you could have seen what happened to him. I don't know.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, there were various stories as to what happened to Penkovsky in real life. It's believed that he was shot in 1963, but there were stories about the KGB pushing him alive into a furnace,
yeah,
in front of a gathering of high-ranking Soviet officers.
Oh boy.
Which, yeah, that would, yeah, have been a scene.
That's a very dark ending to the film, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, if you read Wynne's book, because he wrote a biography, he plays fast and loose with the truth. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can tell he was a salesman. there's a lot of porkies in there. But, it's a shame that they don't, you don't hear more about Penkovsky towards the end. There, he just sort of disappears out of the narrative, doesn't he?
Yeah, and Ian, as a former salesman myself, I'm offended by what you just said, and I completely understand it.
I wonder too if, like, Penkovsky comes to a very grim end. The movie has a bit of like a hopeful ending. You're definitely given the impression that Greville is gonna be haunted by this experience, but it has the kind of hopeful reuniting with the family. Things seems to be going okay for them, although in real life that wasn't really the case. But it wants to end on kind of an upbeat note of hope,
which is the same as Bridge of Spies. You see Mark Rylance, yes, getting pulled into the car. You don't know what that happens with him. You get an idea of what that means, but you don't see it. And then Tom Hanks goes home and hugs his wife.
Yes, but they have in that movie text at the end saying what happened to them.
Sure.
And I wonder if in this movie it's like you have the Penkovsky ending, and then suddenly like a card comes up saying like horrible things that they did to him. The audience, any like kind of moment of hope they had at the end of that movie is instantly erased, and it's a total downer. So I can understand why they're kind of dancing around it.
Yeah, maybe it's just a personal taste thing. I'd be keen to know what you all think. Let us know what ending you would have preferred. Would you like more Penkovsky? Cam, a dislike from you?
Yeah, I'm just going to have kind of a nitpick one, I suppose, or I don't even know if it's a nitpick, but just something I think, you know, we've been comparing it with Bridge of Spies in certain cases.
Mm-hmm.
I think this movie doesn't do quite as strong a job as Bridge of Spies at kind of capturing the atmosphere of paranoia around the Cold War and the nuclear threat. you have a moment where people are hearing, I think it's like a radio broadcast about, like, you know, the duck and cover kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't feel kind of like the intensity of the fear of what was going to happen. And obviously you have them talking about the Cuban Missile Crisis, but I feel like Bridge of Spies did a better job at conveying how people actually felt about it at home. Whereas you don't have a lot of scenes, say, of Jesse Buckley acknowledging these things.
No, I would agree with that, actually. That is another thing I had noted down in my dislikes. And I made a note of a great line in, I can't remember whose speech it was, but it was one of the people on television about how we're living under a nuclear sword of Damocles, which I just thought was a fantastic bit of speech writing there.
Mm.
They use like clips of television and people watching televisions to give you an idea of what's happening in the background, but you never really feel like the Cuban Missile Crisis is actually any actual threat. You just, if you know about the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know what sort of threat that was. But otherwise, if you're showing this to, I mean, we spoke about how this film doesn't really appeal to Gen Zs and Gen Alphas out there, but they may not know what the Cuban Missile Crisis is or was. So giving you a little bit of an idea of what the stakes actually were might have been useful. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, Scott, there's a lot of TikToks about the history of the Cuban Missile Crisis, so clearly you are not hip with the Gen Zs.
The fact that you said hip with the Gen Zs says it all.
But I think as far as if you're actually going by the timelines, the arrest of Penkovsky is before the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Hmm.
Right.
And so, you know, prior to then, there was quite a warming in the relationship between the West and Khrushchev. You know, they were, you know, trying to, Kennedy had been trying to build a decent relationship there with them. And at one point, he actually asked Khrushchev if they wanted to participate in a joint moon mission rather than the US finance it solely.
Mm.
So there was a warming of relations, but obviously then when with the discovery of the missiles on Cuba, then there was an immense cooling down of relations there. So, yeah, I think Bridge of Spies overdoes it, I think, with the nuclear stuff, because you've got the girl watching the atom bomb going off and crying.
Mm, right.
You know, and it's just, I think it's overdone. But maybe that's just me being British.
it is all personal taste. And as Cam said, these are all little nitpicks about a film we all seem to have very much enjoyed. So let's get to sort of final notes before we get to the knock list. Guests are always first. Is there any notes you've got down, Ian, that you haven't mentioned already you'd like to bring up?
Not really. I think I've covered everything, and I've harped on too much about details about timelines and
no
we love that the harping. You're here.
you are our master of all things Cold War. That's why you're here. I've got a couple. Cam, what about you?
I only had a couple things. I'll mention, first of all, we have the introduction of Greville where he's playing golf, and I was thinking about how many spy movies have we seen golf in. Goldfinger's the obvious, but I feel like there was another one.
I would imagine there's quite a few, actually, if you actually look into them. But
I think there might have been a Matt Helm or something where we saw golf.
There's definitely one out there, Cam, but I can't think of it off the top of my head. But it's interesting that you mentioned golf, because I had a golf-related note.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So there's a couple of James Bond nods in this film, and I'll let you all find them yourselves. But here's one. At the beginning of the film, you're introduced to Benedict Cumberbatch playing golf. Now, did you recognize where he was playing golf?
No. Was it the course from Goldfinger?
It was. Stoke Park. It was the Goldfinger course. They even make a point of showing he's using a Dunlop 3.
Wow. Crazy.
And if you remember, Goldfinger uses a Slazenger 7.
That's right, yeah.
Mm. Golf trivia. Who'd have thought you'd get it here, folks? I had a couple more. If you tune into the film at the 1 hour and 41 minute mark, you'll see a glimpse of Cam and I recording the podcast right now.
What?
I'll leave that there. You can go look it up in the film. And if you find it, send us a screenshot and you'll know what I mean.
Okay.
That's just a little bonus gift journey for you all to take. And my final note is I want to give kudos to the casting director for the film, Nina Gold, for managing to find the child actor with the weirdest looking head to match Benedict Cumberbatch's weird looking head.
It's eerie. I actually had that in my notes to mention as well. I was staring at that kid the whole time going like they found Benedict Cumberbatch's like secret love child or something.
I mean, that is the front line of the front page of The Sun tomorrow now, thanks to you, Cam. Benedict Cumberbatch's secret love child found in a 2021 film played by Kia Hills. I'll give the chap a name mention whilst we're here.
Not exactly kept in the shadows if he's being presented in a film as Benedict Cumberbatch's son.
No, a weird way of getting that story out there, isn't it?
It really is. I just had two other notes. Number one, when we are in Russia with Penkovsky, there's an elevator there that looks very dangerous to get off of. It never stops moving, and you have to basically like just get on and off while it's in motion. Mm-hmm. And it reminded me of the crazy elevators from Funeral in Berlin.
Yeah, they like some crazy lifts in Europe, I suppose. Well, not in the UK, but...
there is one in the UK. There's one at Sheffield University.
Is there?
It's called a Paternoster lift, those things.
Mm-hmm. It's at Sheffield. I'm going to have to get up there.
Yeah, there's one there. I mean, sorry, Cam. I just want to mention there's one thing that you've reminded me, which was a local connection for me, because when I lived in London, I used to live in Crouch End, mm-hmm. and the scene where Wynne is outside the underground station, I think it's South Kensington.
Yeah.
Is actually filmed at Hornsey Town Hall that was in Crouch End. So it's made up to look like an underground station. So I was delighted to see there was a local connection, which would have been a stone's throw from where I used to live in London.
Oh, very nice. Well, I mean, I've got a local connection for you just to close out my other notes.
Brilliant.
Which is one of my favorite things to do when I watch movies and they show like movie marquees or anything like that is to note down what is playing within the world of the movie. So when we are getting the tour of Swingin' London of the 1960s on, you know, playing in the theater, not the movie theater, but the actual theater is The Sound of Music, theatrical production. And when they show a movie display marquee, it's actually for the Elvis movie, Girls, Girls, Girls.
Brilliant.
And how is that connected to you, Cam?
I've seen Girls, Girls, Girls. It's terrible. It's truly terrible.
Okay. Yeah, strange the connection, but I appreciate you paying the attention to it.
I always enjoy that part.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, it's that time again, folks. It's time to talk about the knock list. Ian, you're our guest. You'll get the first vote. But for those who are tuning in for the first time, Cam, tell the folks what the knock list is.
Yes, the knock list is the need to see official classics of the Spy Hards podcast, where every week after we talk about a movie, we decide whether it belongs in the pantheon of all-time great spy movies. So it's a lot of competition in there, and movies as notable as North by Northwest or Goldfinger, but also some obscurities like Hannah, Five Fingers. There's some, you know, kind of Spy Hards oddities mixed in. The Spy in Black as well.
And Bridge of Spies.
Yeah, I should have mentioned that first and foremost. Yeah, Bridge of Spies made the knock list, yeah.
So, yeah, Ian, so far you're one for one in terms of getting a film onto the knock list. So I'll go to you for the first vote. Is The Courier making the list of the best spy movies of all time?
Can I just ask, how many are there on the knock list at the moment?
Around about 25.
That sounds right, yeah.
Maybe 30.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's quite a select band.
Quite discerning, most of the time.
couple questionable judgments, but yes.
I would say yes because I just really enjoyed the film and I think it's a really good depiction of an important piece of Cold War history. Mm. So I would say yes, from that point of view, but. I mean, I guess if we've put Bridge of Spies on there, then I would say it's at least equal to that.
Okay. All right. That's a yes. One yes of three. Let's find out what Cam's vote is, Mr. Smith.
I am in very tricky territory with this one.
Okay.
Because I really enjoy this movie. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it ever achieves greatness.
Okay.
And that's something that I struggle with because The Bourne Identity didn't make the list. Spy Game didn't make the list. There's movies I legitimately would recommend to people out there. But when I'm making a list of what I'm trying to create, this, you know, ultimate spy movie list, does The Courier belong on there? I don't know that it does. I think it's a very good, entertaining movie, but I don't know that it quite hits the kind of the heights that I hope for when I'm looking at a movie for the knock list.
So are you on the fence or are you saying no?
I think I'm going to be a soft no on this one.
A soft no. I didn't know we had like consistency scales on the knock list. And so, all right, a soft no.
Well, I like to qualify it because, you know, when we're talking about Cats and Dogs 3, a no to that is not the same as a no to The Courier.
No, and there's been many films over the years that have not made the knock list, but they've still had recommendations from us all the way back to something like The Man from U.N.C.L.E., the Guy Ritchie version of the film. We both enjoyed it, but it didn't quite live up to what it should have been, given with all the pieces put together. And I think that, I think that sort of highlights what you're saying there, Cam. But now it means the answer falls to me, which is very rare when it's a three-way podcast. We have a yes from Ian, a no, a soft no, from Cam. What do I think? And this is an interesting one because I don't ever write down yes or no to the knock list on my notes. I never write down. I just know intrinsically what I want to do with it. And this is the first one in a very long time I've written knock list question mark.
Oh, wow. Well, that was part of my strategy, was to leave you with the deciding vote.
Thank you. Yeah. Now everyone's listening to me and hoping I'll pick either for them or against them if you're a fan or not of this film. Ultimately, I disagree on something you said earlier, Ian, that this is equal to or slightly better than Bridge of Spies. For me, I'd say Bridge of Spies has this pipped a little bit. And there are some quite strong similarities between these two films. They are different in their own way, but there is a lot of connective tissue there as well. You've got sort of the bromance, that sort of stuff, fish out of water, all that sort of joined in there too. But that film has this sort of Spielberg sheen to it, which I think lifts it up a little bit. And there are lots of things I loved about The Courier, and you'll note our dislike section was very short and there wasn't a lot of commentary against the film, and there were small things if there were nitpicks. But there's something about it for me that just isn't ticking. There's just something inside of me that's saying it shouldn't. And so I think I'm actually, if we're going with Cam's hard or soft method, I'm I'm also a soft no. So that means it's one yes and two soft no's, which I think still equal a no. And I'm sorry, Ian, but by the looks of it, The Courier is not making the knock list.
I think that's fair enough. I mean, what I'd say about The Courier is I think it's more textured and nuanced than Bridge of Spies. As you said, Bridge of Spies has got the Spielberg gloss on it, but I think there's far more depth to the characters in this, and you know, I think that's what makes the film, as alongside all the other bits like the cinematography and the set design and all of that bit. But I will bow. It's your podcast. You can overrule me.
To be fair, you've been more successful than most of our guests when people come on the show. A lot of people have been on here three or four times and gotten no's every time. So you've actually managed to get one on the list.
It's true.
That's pretty rare. And I will just add in, I was praising this film when I started talking about it at the beginning of the show. It's still a recommendation for me to go and check it out. If you haven't seen The Courier and you've made it this far in the episode, finish listening and then go and stick it on, because I think you'll have a good time with it. I think for me, it falls into the category of like a spy movie fan's spy movie. But should it be on the list of the best spy movies of all time? I don't think so. But I'd still say it's like, If you finished the knock list and like, hey, I'd like a few more, I would chuck things like this at you and like The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Yeah, and I would say, people, if you haven't seen it, check it out and then tell us why we're wrong.
Yeah, let us know. We're usually often wrong. So
most of the time.
We're used to it now at this point. It's been almost 4 years of talking about spy movies. We've taken a few knocks, if you'll pardon the pun. But there you go. One yes, two no's. The Courier is not making the knock list. The dossier on the film is complete and filed as classified. And all that leaves me to do is say, Ian, thank you ever so much for being on the show. It's been a pleasure to have you back on SpyHards, and it's been a blast speaking with you.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure for me. Delighted to be back. And yeah, if you have any other Cold War movies that you think you'd like my opinion on, then would love to be back.
I think the next one we have you back on for should be a slightly light affair.
Something crazy, like just off the wall.
I've got a film in mind, actually. Yeah. It's not Beloved, but it's certainly crazy and off the wall, as Cam said. But I won't spoil that now. I'll save that for the future. But before we let you go, Ian, we spoke about it at the beginning of the show, but where can people find more about Cold War Conversations?
ColdWarConversations.com. We're also on Twitter at Cold War Pod. Just search for us on Facebook, and we're on Instagram at Cold War Conversations.
There'll be links in the show notes below to all of those locations, plus how you'll be able to find it on things like, you know, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, places like that. But wherever you listen to SpyHards, you can also listen to Cold War Conversations. Subscribe to both. They'll make a nice little accompaniment on your podcast feed.
And also check the show notes, and I'll have a link to the Penkovsky episode for those who want to follow up on the career.
There you go. Right. Wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ian. Well, there you go, folks. That was our chat about 2021's The Courier. I want to once again say thank you to our guest, Mr. Ian Sanders from the Cold War Conversations, for bringing his Cold War expertise onto the show for the second time. It was an absolute blast to have him. And if you haven't checked out Cold War Conversations, do so now with our blessing. And if you want to hear more about The Courier, don't forget to check out our two Spymaster interviews coming out this week. Firstly, with Mr. Tom O'Connor, the screenwriter for the film, the man who came up with the idea for putting the screenplay together and really saw the film through from conception to reception, which is a thing I like to say sometimes because it rhymes. And later this week, we are joined by Mr. Dominic Cook, the director of the film as well. So plenty of background knowledge on The Courier and a lot of love for spy movies in that episode too. So check them both out and let us know what you think of them. Drop us a line at spyhardspod@gmail.com with your thoughts. But now the time has come. The question must go to my favorite Canadian co-host, Mr. Smith. What are we talking about next week?
Scott, we're going back to the gritty 70s with the 1973 Burt Lancaster espionage thriller, Scorpio.
That's right, Cam. If you want some 70s pessimism, a real downbeat spy flick, but an interesting one to talk about, Scorpio is your film. Your mission, folks, should you choose to accept it, is to join us next week as we take a look at Burt Lancaster's Scorpio. If you like what you heard on the show, please consider supporting us over on our Patreon, patreon.com/spyhards, or click the link in the show notes below. Lots of different membership options there and a ton of bonus episodes to gain access to, including our new show, SpyHards OSS, on the small screen as we take a look at the televisual antics of some of our favorite spies, from, you know, James Bond documentaries through to recently we had an episode out looking at the John le Carré BBC adaptation of The Night Manager. One to check out there. Great discussion on a great show that I recommend people check out. But go and find that episode now. And if you don't already, make sure you follow us discreetly on social media at SpyHards. That's SpyHards on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. But until next week, folks, you'll find Cam and I trying our darndest to stay out of that gulag.